Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm John Rogers. We're kicking off 2022 with a double interview for your good selves. We're keeping it in-house. Later on, we'll be hearing from IC Properties writer Alex Newman. He's had a busy week with the government asking house builders for a £4 billion plan to resolve the unsafe cladding crisis and a peer-to-peer property lender launching in the UK. So Alex will be bringing us up to speed. But first, everyone's favourite stock-picking expert, Simon Thompson, is on the pod to discuss a feature he's written this week, Secrets of Successful Investing. Happy New Year, Simon. How are you?
Happy New Year to you too, and all the readers. I'm very fresh. I've come back from annual leave, having taken extended annual leave, and raring to go for the new year.
Delighted to have you back. I'm sure your inbox was full of people wanting you to get back as soon as possible.
It's taken about 2 days to actually clear all the telephone calls and reply to lots of emails too. So I think some of my commentary was missed.
I think so. Well, as I said, you've written the cover feature for this week, Secrets of Successful Investing. And I think off the bat, if anyone was worried about the diligence you put into stock picking, they'll have their mind put at ease, even by the first paragraph where you write that you carry out no less than 16 different risk assessments on companies, from determining how profits are made to geopolitical risk factors even. Could you give us a whistle-stop tour of your process and tell us what are the most significant factors you see in determining quality small companies?
The most important thing is that before you can actually invest in anything, you've got to understand the risk you're actually taking on. And if you don't know how the profits of a company are made and the potential for its growth, then you really are lost from the start. So, I mean, that's the starting point. I look at other things which, you know, the annual report and accounts and trading statements and interim accounts reveal these, such as the robustness of cash generation, balance sheet strength. I look at the quality of management and their track record. That's really important. The pricing power, is there a moat around the business, you know, in terms of margins and the level and sustainability of those margins? I also look at the end markets being sold into and the scope for growth for those. That's very important. And don't forget currency. Obviously, you know, UK is quite a small country, and lots of the companies I follow actually export overseas and have overseas operations. So the impact of currency fluctuations on profitability is one major factor of the 16 that I look at. Because I look for companies with strong balance sheets and generally conservatively geared, so low net debt or net cash positions, I also look for potential for earnings enhancing acquisitions that are complementary to the existing business. But don't forget the risks, the downside risks, such as, you know, profit warning risk. You know, are you buying into a situation where the risk is, you know, if that happening is too high? You've got geopolitical risk. So there's some territories where companies are very lowly rated, but there's a reason for that. You've also got economic risk, which I'll touch on later. I had a whole section of the feature on that. Liquidity risk, well, I cover small cap stocks. You've got to look at the liquidity of the stocks that you're actually getting into. So you can actually buy into them, but can you actually get out? And also the volatility of them. I look at previous downturns, recessions, periods of economic weakness to ascertain how robust the profitability of a company is and how quickly profits actually returned in the upcycle. And, you know, we've had a good example of that in the last 2 years with, you know, the deepest recession we've seen in living memory, followed by one of the strongest bounce backs ever. And it's only when you've actually covered all these key risk factors and actually understands the company, the industry, the business models, that you can then actually look at the valuation of the company. And that's where my stock picking ability actually kicks in, because I'm actually looking for companies where the upside potential from the share price market value is at least 2 times and sometimes 3 times the downside risk. So if the downside risk is 15% of the current stock price, I'm looking between 30 and 45% upside. And the reason I've been able over the years, and this is just a rough figure, but it's representative of all the bargain share portfolios I've actually covered over the last two decades. But I've got a hit rate of between 75 and 80% of the companies I cover actually produce a positive outcome for this stock price for people actually investing. So if you can actually run the winners, cut the losers, you'll actually have a positive outcome on your portfolio. But equally, one thing that many investors don't do, which I think is very important, and my colleague, columnist and former fund manager John Rozier does this to great effect, is actually then weight the risk. So having gone through all these different factors and actually understood how risky the investment you're actually looking at is, then you've got to risk weight that company, that share in your portfolio. So should it have a 5% weighting in your portfolio? Should it only be 2%? The point is, you don't want to get hit by a poor performance of one stock to drag down the whole portfolio badly just because you've actually overweighted it because you misunderstood the risk. So that's just the start of my stock picking process. And then I kick on to other factors like the economy and monetary policy, and which is incredibly interesting.
Well, yes, let's talk about that now with in relation to this year, 2022, in terms of macroeconomic and monetary policy. What are you expecting to see in 2022, and how will that affect you?
I basically laid out my my view in the future that I believe that both sides of the Atlantic, so the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, will be tightening the monetary policy. We've had this quantitative easing effects, which has buoyed financial markets for the last 2 years. And what you've got to remember is that QE, the aim of it is to drive down long-term bond yields, force investors up the risk curve in search of higher returns relative to bonds, boost asset prices, and create a positive wealth effect. Well, that's clearly worked. You know, you've had record highs for stock markets on both sides of the Atlantic. And equally, you know, we had record low for bond prices last year. But the elephant in the room is inflation. And we're seeing that coming out now, that in the States earlier this week, the monetary authorities reported that inflation had hit a 40-year high of 7%. Well, we'll see that same high in the UK come April, when our retail price index will be hitting 7%, and there's even a possibility of CPI hitting 7%. Well, the point is that with tight labour markets, low unemployment, and relatively low interest rates, the monetary authorities on both sides of the Atlantic have got to start tightening quite dramatically short-term interest rates. So the US Federal Reserve are predicted in the future forward curve to actually push through four rate rises of 0.25% this year. In the UK, it's going to be at least three rises of 0.25%. Economists actually agree on that. And more next year. And that's going to have an effect on the yield that bond investors require to actually hold bonds. And in turn, that has implications for the sectors that you should be holding, because the sectors that did incredibly well since the start of pandemic, like technology and e-commerce, have actually benefited from cash money at zero yields. So it's a zero interest rate policy environment. Now, as soon as you actually start increasing bond yields, that has a negative impact on some of those companies. So my view this year is that the easy gains from financial markets have actually been made. And you're going to have to take a thematic stock picking view, a strategy, to actually outperform markets. So you can't actually ride off the market coattails anymore, is what I'm saying. And I just feel at this point of the economic cycle, increasing exposure to cyclical value plays, so low price to book value stocks that offer a decent dividend yields and decent cash flow, is quite a sensible strategy in view of what I believe is going to happen in the monetary policy environment.
And which inflation camp are you in? Are you in the it's here to stay for a while, or likely to fall? I know we've had IC contributors on both sides. I believe it's Steve Clapham who who thinks it's going to stick around a while Cristello thinks it's going to fall. Which camp are you in?
I think it's going to be temporary, but it's going to be a higher level over the next 2 years than the market is actually anticipating, or many investors are anticipating. That's why I'm taking a more cautious view to the sectors that I'd actually be looking at this year, until we've actually got a real feel for how it's going to play out. And ultimately, it's dependent on a number of factors, such as the strength of the global economic recovery, which is still coming through in certain segments, and also commodity prices, which I've done a whole section on commodity prices for the future. But we've seen that, you know, for energy prices in the UK, you know, when the price cap is announced on the 7th of February, you're going to see 50% plus rises in the energy costs for consumers, which is clearly inflationary. But equally, in 12 months from now, you're not going to see another 50% rise. So you've got various factors at play. So I'm basically saying inflation is going to be high. It's going to probably exceed most people's expectations, but I would expect it to drop back at some point next year.
Yes, you mentioned you have a whole section on commodity price drivers. One of them you point out is copper, and I wondered why you highlighted that one in particular.
I've studied commodities in quite some depth, and I've produced a lot of recommendations in the sector or for that commodity. The primary reason is it's a major beneficiary from greater demand for electricity, given that a high proportion of future power generation is actually forecast to come from renewables. To give you some perspective on that, wind farms and solar panels require almost 5 times more copper than that needed for fossil fuel power generation. Electric vehicles use 4 times as much copper as internal combustion engine vehicles. All the infrastructure programs announced, both in the US, the UK, across Europe, they've got one thing. These are government infrastructure programs. They've got one thing in common: they're copper intensive. And it's no surprise to me that, you know, the copper price, having sold off in the autumn, is actually bouncing back and is almost trading at the all-time high that we saw in May last year. Because you've got these demand drivers that will literally fuel demand for copper for decades to come. To give you an insight into that, one research consultancy I spoke to says that green technology alone will account for 20% of estimated global consumption by 2030. Whereas if you go back a decade, it's a fraction of that.
And you picked out some specific companies that might benefit from this as well.
Yeah, I mean, the three that I like a lot is 3M traded stocks: Metal Tiger, Jubilee Metals, and Trident Royalties. Metal Tiger has exposure through a holding in an Australian listed company called Sandfire, which is a $1 billion market cap company listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. And it's got exposure through the Kalahari Copper Belt. Jubilee Metals, again, that's got exposure through copper, which is ramping up production in Africa. And Trident Royalties has got royalty streams from copper producers. So all three give you exposure to, you know, future upsides in the metal. But even at the current price, the profits these companies are going to be making in years to come are going to be huge from the copper exposure.
Moving on, in terms of global markets, you've singled out Vietnam in this article. You're not the only one. I seem to remember Mary McDougall highlighted it as an area for interest in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, my view last year, I was hunting. If I go one step back, I've always felt that investors should take a global view of their portfolios. So if you can't get exposure through the domestic market, just look wider. You know, it's one tap on a keyboard on an online dealing page to actually gain exposure to overseas stock markets. And at the start of last year, before I was compiling my bargain share portfolio for 2021, I was looking at areas that I expected to benefit both from an economic bounce back, but countries that actually fared quite well during the pandemic. So they start the bounce back very, very quickly. And Vietnam stood out. And within that, I then hunted. This is what I do. I take a thematic approach to investing, and then I actually hunt down value opportunities within those themes. And the one that I came out with was Vietnam Holding, which is, it's a small, below-the-radar, close-end fund, so investment trust, portfolio of 20 to 25 mid-cap, small-cap companies. And it's basically a play on three secular trends in Vietnam: industrialization, urbanization, and domestic consumerism. To say that that has played out is, would be an understatement. The share price is up 90% in the last 12 months. It still trades at a discount to net asset value. And more importantly, given the earnings growth for the constituents' portfolio companies, effectively, the trust is only trading on a price per earnings ratio for 2022 of about 12, which I can see actually upside to that valuation, which is why I'm still positive on it. I also included the second oldest investment trust, closed-end fund in Canada. It's Canadian General Investments. It's had the same portfolio manager for over 50 years. And the reason I actually chose that was that it had an overweight position on US tech stocks. It had been taking profits on some of them, but it also had exposure to, older, more traditional North American holdings that benefit from the US economic recovery. And again, that's panned out. It's, to date, the total return from that holding is around about 25%. But the point is, with both of those, it would be impossible for me to replicate their portfolios, or for any investor, to be honest, in a cost-efficient manner. So the sensible way was to actually buy into them, to actually play those themes. And that's exactly what I'm doing at the moment. I'm looking at my 2022 bargain share portfolio, which will be published on the 11th of February. And I'm looking at gaining exposure to other international areas through trusts in that way that I've got a very strong view on.
Great. Simon, I'm keen not to keep you for too long, and as well to leave some of this article sort of secret, so people can go and go on and read it as well. Is there anything else from this article that you'd like to just touch on now before we finish?
Well, I actually perhaps one final point is that, which many investors don't look at, is how to capitalize on capital returns, be it share buybacks, tender offers, and special dividends. And in the feature, I've actually given or highlighted one example. It was a AIM traded investment company called Gresham House Strategic. It's now called Rockwood Realization. And it had a tender offer and cash return last year. I've been following this stock since 2016 when I included the shares in my bargain portfolio that year. It's more than doubled, more than 100% total return since then. But the point is that anyone that actually saw the announcement last autumn, in terms of this, cash return and tender offer, would have made about a 12% total return on their capital, while at the same time having 44% of their capital returned in cash to them by actually playing it. And that's one of the things I actually look out for, is tender offers and capital returns, because not many private investors actually focus on those. And as a result, these valuation anomalies can actually arise. And to make a 12% return on your capital within space of about 5-6 weeks, basically you've made an annual return in a tenth of the year. Anyway, in the feature, I actually highlight how it worked and things to actually look out for. So it's well worth a read.
It is well worth a read, and it can be found on our websites or in the physical magazine. That's Secrets of Successful Investing. Simon, thank you so much for your time.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Next up, welcome to the podcast, Alex Newman, who is covering properties this week, and he's had a busy one. There's been a lot to talk about. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Quite good, thanks, John. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Let's start with the biggest story of the week, which you've been all over. Housing Secretary Michael Gove has laid the cost of the cladding crisis, the flammable cladding, on the doorstep of house builders as opposed to leaseholders in what he's called a New Deal. Alex, what is in the New Deal and what's the reaction been?
Yeah, so Michael Gove, it was kind of leaked over the weekend, last weekend, various reports putting out that he was going to tap the developers for an extra $4 billion to help resolve the cladding crisis. I mean, we can sort of backtrack slightly on what this all stemmed from is the, as everyone knows, the 2017 Grenfell Tower fire, which in the wake of that revealed just the chronic sort of poverty of the of building standards over the last few decades. And this is sort of the latest iteration of a sort of social political settlement with the developers who have, you know, on their watch, a lot of these buildings have been built. So the news on Monday, Michael Gove, the Housing Secretary, as you said, said he is sort of using various measures to pressure the property developers into coughing up £4 billion, and this is specifically going to go towards buildings between 11 meters and 18 meters. The government's previously said that above that limit, they're gonna kick in quite a lot of the money. There are still, you know, huge questions resolved for tenants of properties below that level, and all the other remedial work that's been identified since Grenfell and how that's going to be fixed. So £4 billion is the number that's been bandied around this week. You know, some campaigners are saying it's closer to £15 billion, the amount that needs to be stumped up. Where that comes for and on whose shoulders that falls is kind of the big question for investors, and that's what we've seen play out this week.
Before this announcement, property developers, they weren't doing nothing. I mean, some of them had already started contributing towards removing unsafe cladding.
Absolutely, yeah. So obviously seeing the way the wind's been blowing and, you know, sitting on enormous, you know, a decade of enormous profits, basically. The largest house builders, sort of among them, Persimmon, Taylor Wimpey, Barratt Developments, I suppose you could say proactively, or whether it's after the fact, set aside provisions for various remedial work. So some of this is essentially improving the cladding quality, which has been sort of the most visible aspect of this. Others have identified other refits and improvements that need to be made. In Barratt's case, they have bought back some of the properties which were found to be faulty. So there's been a range of redress so far, and it's kind of it's sort of totting up, and I think we're getting towards the £1 billion mark that they've either identified so far or agreed to pay. What I suppose the question is what's happening next, and the reason why a lot of the house builder shares fell, you know, sort of 3-4% on Monday is kind of a signal that government actually wants a bigger take. In October, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a tax on the profit, additional tax on the profits of developers with profits of at least £25 million pounds. So that's going to add a 4% charge to the taxes of those developers. And so the balance now is whether they, you know, the Gove is going to go after developers through a kind of one-off windfall or hiking that tax that's sort of initially been agreed.
Are there any silver linings from this from a house builder's point of view? I mean, it's a fairly large figure, but it is a figure, I suppose, and it's a figure that they haven't had before now.
Yeah. I think that both parties are trying to arrive at a consensus. In that sense, that is a positive, I suppose. If you're an investor in this sector, last year wrote a piece just comparing the cladding scandal to the PPI mis-selling scandal, which I suppose the issue there for investors in bank shares, that was sort of very, very long running financial redress, which ran into the tens and tens of billions of pounds, was that there was never really an end in sight during the payments which were being made. It seems now that the government wants to round on this 4 billion number, and some of the letters that were leaked between the Treasury and the Department for Levelling Up over the weekend, there was even talk about if this 4 billion pounds figure cannot be reached, in other words, if you can't get everything you're looking for fairly from the developers, which may have contributed to this issue, then some of it is going to have to come out of the Levelling Up budget. Now, I think that's probably unlikely, because it would be a bit of a political mess if taxpayers are seem to be adding more to fix this crisis. And it would also suggest that, despite these harsh words this week, that, you know, Gove et al. Can't follow up their, you know, the pressure they're putting on the developers. But there is a number in sight. And in some cases, you know, Alistair Jeffries pointed out, Persimmon, Taylor Wimpey especially, they seem to have modelled for quite a lot of these costs. They're going to have to add in extra through taxation over the next 5 years. But it is unlikely, I think, that they're going to be the runaway costs which might have been feared not so long ago. And obviously, it's in the interest of both parties to reach a number rather than letting this play out in the courts.
And obviously, you mentioned that the news initially hit a few of the big players: Persimmon, Barrett, Taylor Wimpey, Berkeley, etc. How in the short and medium term, what's the outlook for these companies? Simon Thompson pointed out to me that in the past 20 years, the largest first quarter decline in the house building sector has been 6.5%, which is where it is at the moment, and 85% of the time within that quarter it's rallied. What's your outlook?
Yeah, I was unaware of that stat in terms of the sort of mean reversion. I mean, the thing you have to say about the house builders is that they are astonishingly cheap, both in relative terms to the rest of the market and in historic terms. So they just continue to throw off enormous amount of cash. Obviously, they benefit from this supply-demand imbalance that we have in the UK when it comes to housing. They've been able to swallow the cost inflation that they've seen over the last 2 years, mainly by passing it on, or just rising with the tide which has lifted all residential property boats over the last, which has been house prices. So they have these huge structural moats and positions, which I don't think are going away anytime soon. They are, they're kind of, they're not quite back to the peak of profitability they were at in sort of 2018, when Help to Buy really turbocharged their profits. But I mean, they look cheap on almost any standard. I think there are lots of risks facing the house builders, but I find it, I'm sort of increasingly of the view that they are, you know, they can handle the pressures that are coming their way, be it interest rates, these kind of levies coming from government. They're just so cash generative, their balance sheets are so cashed up, that, you know, the sort of 10, 11 times forward earnings multiples they're sitting on, Persimmon, I think, paying like a 9% dividend now. You don't really find that elsewhere among blue chip companies. And I can't see them losing that momentum anytime soon. So they're probably near enough, I'd say, the bottom they're going to be price-wise.
And let's just quickly talk about some of the other pieces you've written this week. Firstly, headline: London house price growth prospects look shaky. This is something that hasn't been the case for 20 years. I think you're right that between 2002 and 2020 there was 4.8% growth a year, and in 2021 that did drop to 2.1%. So
I should correct you there. So 4.8 nationally, in London it's been 5.8. So but the longer running trend is, as you say, it's been we've had at least three enormous boom periods since the 80s.
So what's the worry now? Is it a COVID fueled issue?
In part, yeah, I don't think we can separate COVID from anything in sort of financial markets or the world, still, unfortunately. Just to contradict everything I've just said about the enormity of house price inflation you've seen nationally, the issue, there's a number of issues in London, which those betting on house price growth indefinitely. And I think it's been said many times before, and the London market is, defied it many, many times. But I see there are certain market events where I think there's almost a kind of buffer coming up for house prices. So one is the kind of supply demand question. I mean, London, it's interesting to see going through the stats over the last 20 years, its population has grown by 25%. So in an era of, rock bottom interest rates, that really puts a floor under house price growth. It doesn't look like any that London, that sort of population increase is likely to slow down massively. But there is this dynamic of lots of long-term Londoners or younger Londoners who are just saying that the capital is either unaffordable or have looked at their lives post-pandemic and decided that actually, from a quality of life perspective, there are places they can live elsewhere and still have, do their jobs and be happier. So I think there is a kind of interesting dynamic on the sort of push pull and just how much appetite there is for London housing stock versus, recent years. And the other one, sort of related to that on affordability, is that we're sort of really against the buffers of what the average or what the median household can afford here. So for the last few years, it's been over 12 times, the ratio has been 12 times sort of the average house to median earnings. And that compares to, in the north, it's sort of less than six. So the chance for the average young family to get on the housing ladder is in the last 10 years has become markedly slimmer. The fact, the one element that I think people may be sort of underweighting is that we haven't really had much interest rate growth in that 10 years, and we've not really tested what happens to mortgage affordability, which is a decent proxy for house buying appetite in London. So I can't really see, if we're getting up to 1% interest rates by the end of the year, as some people are forecasting, how we can maintain these such wide gaps between incomes and house prices. I think there are going to be some real pinch points ahead for London house prices.
And sorry, just at the risk of running out of time, you've written one more piece this week about a new peer-to-peer lending property lender, called Estate Guru.
So yeah, I mean, they're new in the sense that they're launching in the UK. My understanding is that UK investors have been able to participate in the platform until now, but because they haven't had an FCA license, they've been unable to market their financial products. And also because the way a peer-to-peer lender works, you have borrowers going on the site launching projects. They're normally sort of short-term property projects, and then lenders / investors offering to provide the debt to fund those. And so on the borrower side, UK borrowers haven't been able to list their projects on Estate Guru. But yeah, so it's been going since 2014. It's an Estonian company. They're quite widespread across Europe now. And as of this week, they've done about €500 million of lending. I mean, their track record and the figures are very strong. So they've had very, very low losses to date. But it just caught my eye, this story, because they, 11% yields inevitably going to attract a sort of property and yield obsessed nation like the UK. And I imagine there'll be quite a lot of interest once, it gets a bit more recognition over here. But, you know, I suppose the devil is in the detail. And the question that's faced lots of peer-to-peer lenders before is balancing this credit risk with, you know, with the appetite of investors, particularly when those sort of rates are teased before them. So we've, you know, been a number of peer-to-peer lenders in the past decade who have not been able to live up to the initially heady promises that they've made. So it'll be interesting to see if they can navigate these larger markets they are now entering successfully whilst juggling these, you know, both sides of the lending ball.
Great. Yeah, too good to be true, I guess. It remains to be seen. Thank you so much, Alex, for joining me. Those articles can be found on the ICE websites and in the magazine. Alex, thank you for your time, and we'll catch you another one. See you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. That was a little bit different to our normal interview format, but we hoped you enjoyed listening to some of our own senior writers. We're in the process of planning a new podcast series where we do hear from ICE writers about the week's news. We'd love your feedback on this idea or any of our other podcasting. If you have any thoughts, please drop me an email at john.rogers@ft.com. That's john.rogers@ft.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.